Why did 90% of all species living on Earth go extinct around a quarter of a billion years ago? Was this caused by global warming? We'll seek some answers from our guest, Dr. Paul Wignall. He's from the School of Earth and Environments at the University of Leeds in Britain. After decades of research and publications, Dr. Wignall is one of the world's experts on past extinctions. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
So when did you start studying extinction events and why?
Quite a long time ago now, about 25 years ago. And the why is because they're interesting. But also at the time, there was a lot of interest in the extinction of the dinosaurs that had been sort of rumbling on for a few years. And so I became interested in that. And then I thought I'd like to have a look at other mass extinctions, including the one you've just mentioned 250 million years ago.
Right. Now, before we get into some of those fascinating details about how unstable life is here on Earth, I have one quick question for our listeners. Does the study of the past really tell us anything important about the rapid warming humans are causing today?
Yes, very much so. I mean, we can only study the world as it is today, but if we look in a geological past, then we can see the way the world worked in the past and what happens when you have phenomena like rapid warming and rapid cooling and so on. So it's kind of a sort of experiments that have been run in the past, basically, and we can see what happened.
Now, you have studied rock formations and the fossils in them all over the world, from Poland to my own Canadian province of British Columbia. But I noticed, particularly after 2006, most of your papers are co-authored with Chinese scientists. Why is that?
Because they have similar research interests to me, but also there's a lot of, the appropriate rocks of the right age in China, particularly in South China. So I've done a lot of field work with Chinese colleagues in sort of southwest China in Yunnan province and Sichuan province and places like that.
So rocks are almost like a book. You go where the best and easiest to read book is.
That's right, yep. I've ended up traveling quite a few places in the world, but as you say, it's what you have to do if you want to see the rocks of the right age.
Now, your work has touched on a number of controversies raised by other scientists here on Radio EcoShock, and I'd like to start with your 2009 paper, Mantle Plume, the Invisible Serial Killer. What is a mantle plume?
A mantle plume is a sort of a structure or feature within the Earth, within the mantle, and it basically refers to sort of hot material that we think sort of wells up from the core, from the center of the Earth, and rises up to the just beneath the crust. And when it reaches the base of the Earth's crust, it then creates a lot of volcanism.
Now, what came out of that made it a serial killer?
It's mainly the scale. I mean, volcanic eruptions are sort of, the style of eruptions are sort of familiar in Hawaii today. So they're sort of basalt lava flows, but they're just much bigger than normally, these plume eruptions. So that rather than involving sort of, typically a lava flow will be a few cubic kilometers or a few cubic miles of lava, these are just orders of magnitude bigger scale eruptions.
Now, does that involve methane?
It does, but in a sort of rather complex, indirect sort of way. Volcanoes erupt out carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide and some other gases as well, and very little methane on its own. But we think that the eruption, particularly of carbon dioxide, triggers the release of methane. Do you want me to explain how we think that works?
Yeah, I'm interested because the Russian scientists, including Natalia Shakova, have suggested a 50 gigaton burst of methane could escape into the atmosphere, but I'm thinking that may not be connected to what you're talking about, is it?
Not directly, yes. I mean, there's not much methane comes out with volcanism, with volcanic eruptions, but there is methane trapped in places like permafrost and in beneath the ocean floor as well, which can be released particularly if you get warming started.
And I noticed that some scientists, including E. Haydari, disagreed with your mantle plume theory. Scientists do argue, don't they, even if politely, in journals?
Yes, we're not allowed to swear in journals, but we can have sort of quite strong arguments, I guess. You have to be careful. It's just it's the way you phrase it, really. But there's a lot of different ideas out there and quite a lot of competing theories, so it's almost inevitable that you end up arguing.
Now, Paul Wignall, you and your Chinese co-authors published another paper in 2012 that caused kind of a stir. You suggested Earth experienced lethally hot temperatures during the early Triassic greenhouse. What was lethally hot and when?
Yes, this is. It certainly was controversial, but I think we're right about this. We've recorded the warmest interval probably for the last billion years of Earth's history. It's in the aftermath of this huge extinction 250 million years ago, and it seems that extinction coincided with warming, and we think the warming just got even worse in the aftermath of it, and so produced temperatures. We calculated sea surface temperatures rather than on land, but sea surface temperatures were approached 40 degrees centigrade at times, which is extremely hot, certainly well over 110 degrees Fahrenheit. So.
Well, that's hotter than our hottest baths. It's hotter than our own bodies. It's hard to imagine the seas being that hot.
It's true. It is very hard to imagine, and you're right. It's hotter if you could just about tolerate having a shower or a bath at 40 degrees, but only just. It would feel scaldingly hot. It's a bit sort of temperature of hot soup, really, I'd say. This is at the equator. We didn't say these temperatures were all over the world. The sort of equator temperatures were that, and we think actually at higher latitudes, temperatures were probably quite normal. It gets cooler towards the poles, and so the polar temperatures were not too bad. But certainly at the equator, we think it became lethally hot, and so it became impossible for many animals and many groups to live in equatorial waters.
In an interview for Naked Scientists, you said all forests were lost at that time, which is an amazing thought in itself, and it was a catastrophic time for insects as well. Could you tell us a bit about what happened to the trees and the bugs?
Yes, at the mass extinction itself, it's remarkable. It's the worst time that plants have ever had since they first colonized land. And so we see the loss of the dominant types of tree, which are gymnosperm groups, think like modern-day conifers and pine trees belong to these groups. But the ones around at that time, the main tree groups, families, disappear, as do a lot of the major insects around at the time as well. It's the only real crisis, severe crisis, that the insects have ever suffered. So just, if you like, it's a measure of just how bad this mass extinction was.
So what do scientists think caused this great mass extinction? I mean, it wasn't an asteroid, was it?
No, it's linked with, as we were just talking about, there's a gigantic volcanic eruptions in Siberia. We call them the Siberian Traps today, this region, and it's a huge area of basalt lava flows. And it's the gases that came out associated with those eruptions that we think did all the damage.
So this wasn't just a single event. It developed in stages. Could you talk to us about those stages?
Yeah, so we think the volcanism came out in a series of giant flows, and each flow would probably be several 10,000 cubic kilometers of lava, which is a gigantic amount of lava for one flow. And there's a whole series of these flows stacked up on top of each other. And we think particularly during the first few flows, there was also a huge amount of gas eruptions as well associated with them. And so, if you like, the lava is like a smoking gun, but is not the actual cause. I'm not sure if that works, that analogy. But anyway, it's not the actual cause of the extinction, but it's telling us we have a lot of eruptions, and it's the gas that comes out, which we have much less direct evidence of, that causes the actual extinction. So if you like, the lava tells us there was a lot of eruptions, and then we assume, like you usually have, there was a lot of gas came out with those eruptions.
Now, looking at that event and other extinctions you have studied, what species are most likely to recover quickly from an extreme heating crisis, and which ones may take a very long time to come back, if ever?
That's an interesting question. You can almost sort of predict beforehand what's going to recover quickly and what isn't. It's just that some groups evolve very quickly. So there's a group known as the ammonites, which sadly they're now extinct today, but they're a group of mollusks with nice little spiral shells. And they suffered badly during many extinctions. They don't do very well during many crises, but they bounce back very quickly, and so they evolve very fast indeed. And so we see those doing very well. There's other groups which sort of just plod along, and they don't evolve very fast at all. So in the sea, you have groups like the clams or the bivalves, as we know them, and they do recover, but they're sort of much slower pace of recovery.
And you've talked about a lot of volcanoes blowing off, and I picture a lot of dust and dirt in the atmosphere and possibly a short-term global cooling. Did that happen, and did that stress life on Earth?
Probably, yes. This is one of the tricky things about understanding the full implications of volcanism. You're right. There's definitely volcanoes cause cooling because of all the gas and the aerosols that they produce. And that's very short term. It can be very severe, but it may only last a few years because the dust gets rained out of the atmosphere quite quickly. And that makes it difficult for geologists to spot. We're good at resolving things that happened over sort of thousands of years, but trying to spot something that just took a few years is very hard because you don't have much in the way of rock to look at for such a short amount of time. We think we're on firmer ground looking at longer-term effects like global warming, which do seem to last thousands and tens of thousands of years, and so leave a much more sort of tangible record in both the fossils and the rocks.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about past mass extinction events with Dr. Paul Wignall from the University of Leeds. Well, you've also published work on a different mass extinction, this time in the Middle Permian. Can you tell us when that was, and did species die off at that time due to warming or cooling, or what do we think?
Yes, there's a whole series of these extinctions. So the one in the Middle Permian was about 260 million years ago, and it has the same old culprit of a gigantic volcanic province, gigantic pile of lava flows, which are now in southern China. So we see them in China and just into northern Vietnam as well. There's similar sort of range of victims in the sea with lots of shellfish. Animals like brachiopods disappear at this time. The ammonoids have a tough time as well. So it's pretty similar to the extinction we were talking about, the slightly younger extinction 250 million years ago, except it's not quite as severe. It's not quite such a gigantic, if you like, catastrophe, but nonetheless it was a crisis.
Now, I'd like to move on to another theory about a crisis in the sea. Now, we've had author and paleoclimatologist Peter Ward as a guest several times on Radio EcoShock. His book, Under a Green Sky, affected me deeply. You published a paper in 2012 on green sulfur bacteria, and those seem to be the same agents that Ward suggested arose in oxygen-poor oceans, and maybe their hydrogen sulfide breath, if we want to call it that, may have caused mass death in land animals. What did you find, and does it correspond to Ward's theory?
Yes, I mean, these green sulfur bacteria is a sort of a marker for oceans which have gone, if you like, horribly wrong. So they've lost the normal oxygen which we find, which most oceans have most of the time. And so you start getting a different type of bacteria which produces hydrogen sulfide as a byproduct. And that's a pretty nasty gas, a dissolved gas in the sea, which kills off animals, basically. No animals can survive in the presence of H2S, hydrogen sulfide. So yes, it's certainly part of the extinction story. The understanding of it is how do the ocean get to that state? Why does it lose its oxygen? And I think that goes back to the factors like warming. As oceans that warm get less oxygen dissolved in them, and they seem to mix less well, and so it becomes they become poorly ventilated.
Now, a lot of this comes from one of your specialties, which is the study of anoxia, and that's a word seldom used by the public, although we've just been talking about it. What does it mean, and what does it tell us about the past?
Yes, anoxia is sort of, it's just lack of oxygen, basically. So we've all animals, all plants, we breathe oxygen, and we need oxygen, but you can have environments which where there is no oxygen available. You can find it in most sort of muddy seabeds. You can find it by digging. If you dig down into the sediment, you'll find the oxygen is lost, and you'll reach a layer of the sediment where it becomes anoxic. There is no oxygen available. That's normal, but it becomes very sort of strange or sort of atypical if you start getting anoxic conditions within the water column. And then life's in big trouble. Then nothing can live on the seabed, and it becomes hard for animals swimming around in the water to survive. So it's that sort of open water anoxia which is really, really harmful.
Now, as you know, dead zones are popping up in the ocean around the world. We are generally told they're due to enriched runoff from the land. Could there be other causes?
Yes, there's a whole sort of suite of causes that cause this. You're right. If the runoff from the land, essentially pollution, particularly sewage pollution into the sea, is an effective way of taking oxygen out. But also temperature is important. Warmer waters don't have as much oxygen in them, so that doesn't help either. And you can also get nutrients will supply from deep water can also produce sort of high productivity of plankton in the surface waters, and that in the long term doesn't help oxygenation either. So there's a whole bunch of factors. On a global scale, it's important for the oceans as how much sort of global mixing there is between the polar latitudes and the equatorial latitudes as well. And we think that might decrease as the world gets warmer as well.
And I found something a bit like poetry in scientific language, of course, in a paper you co-authored with Song and others. The title was Anoxia High Temperature Double Whammy During the Permian-Triassic Marine Crisis and Its Aftermath. And this paper talks about a narrow band where life survived between waters too hot and seas too low on oxygen. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that paper was about there's sort of two different stresses killing animals, but one working its way down from the surface of the oceans and one working its way up from the deep. And so, in effect, just leaving us a little band in between where it's kind of just about okay, I guess. So the depletion of oxygen usually occurs from sort of the seabed upwards, or sort of the ocean bed upwards, whereas the high temperatures, which is also harmful, goes from sort of surface waters downwards. It gets the warmest waters at the surface and it gets cooler as you go into the ocean depths. And so both those, lack of oxygen and high temperatures, aren't good, but they sort of move, they act in different directions within the water column.
Now, Paul Wigdell, I found missing from these papers, it seemed to me anyway, on extinction events, the so-called evil twin of climate change, namely ocean acidification. Is that because acidification is hard to study in ancient rocks?
Yes, it's a tricky thing to get at, is acidification. It may well be part of the crisis and the extinction story, but we have very little in the way of a direct measure of how acidic water is in the past. The problems for geologists, of course, the water itself doesn't fossilize. You just have the sediment that accumulated beneath it, and it is hard to, if you like, disentangle that factor. And also, it's hard to know which of the different sort of ways of killing things that we've spoken of. It's hard to know, are they all equally bad, or is one worse than the others? What's the crucial killing mechanism rather than just to say that, well, everything did it. It's quite important to know which is the most lethal, if you like.
So in the ice cores we get from Greenland, there's little bits of air trapped in the ice cores, but there's no equivalent of little bits of water we could study trapped in the rocks?
Sadly not, no. We have sort of indirect ways of getting at past ocean waters and looking at the various ratios of elements and things. But no, there's nothing too straightforward.
And looking into the dying ocean life in the past, you've also raised concerns about disappearing polar ice. Arctic and even Antarctic ice is melting rapidly now. If we lose that ice covering, what does your study of the past suggest that might mean for ocean life?
The simple loss of life, I guess there's two things that will happen. One will be sea level rise, which will be bad for mankind, anybody living in coastal regions. But that'll, on its own, that's fine for marine life because that just increases the area of marine habitat. But it's a change in ocean circulation as a result of that. The oceans circulate today very well because it's very cold at high latitudes and much warmer at low latitudes, and so you end up with a conveyor of warm waters heading to higher latitudes, and you get this sort of deep, cold water sinking from the poles. And so that type of circulation will decrease.
Now, these things about no ice at the poles, a stagnant ocean, that probably would take thousands of years, if not longer. Why should we worry about it now?
You're right. Yeah, I don't see this as an imminent catastrophe. The oceans, they're so huge of the oceans, and just changing the temperature of the oceans takes a lot of effort, if you like, a lot of energy to do it. So it happens on a hundreds of years to thousands of years scale. But nonetheless, on the way to getting to that sort of state, you will start to see the gradual onset of sort of harmful conditions. Certainly the areas in the ocean which are rather low in oxygen are beginning to increase, particularly in low latitude midwaters and so on. So you will start to see some of these effects. I don't think the sort of conditions, the sort of catastrophic conditions of 250 million years ago, I can't see that happening hopefully it'll never happen, but it's maybe thousands of years away from today.
Yeah, this is something that Dr. James Lovelock was talking about, was the possibility of stagnation in the oceans, and maybe we'd have to put pipes in to get the ocean moving again. But as we're saying now, that is a long way off.
It is. I mean, to get to that sort of stage, it's what happens in between, I guess. Do little sort of incremental changes in ocean circulation, will they be harmful or not? I mean, for me personally, I think the significant damage we're doing to the oceans today is all to do with overfishing and sort of just depleting fisheries and so on, which is obviously nothing to do with environmental changes. It's all to do with not managing fish stocks.
And what will you be researching next?
Next, I've got a couple of projects at the moment. I've moved back in time to have a look at the first mass extinction, which was 510 million years ago. And to see if that's, in fact, it's starting to look rather similar to all other mass extinctions, actually, but it's just to see how that sort of panned out and what happened in those times. So that's one project. But also I'm interested in the time after the 250 million year extinction, known as the end Permian extinction, There was then the subsequent sort of recovery in the next sort of 50 million years are rather fascinating. So I've been looking at, or just starting to look at that as well. It's a time when lots of modern groups evolve, like the mammals and the flowering plants, and the dinosaurs came along as well, of course. So it's looking at the sort of what controlled the appearance of the new groups after this big sort of wipeout at the end of the Permian.
And you're talking about controls, and one thing that I've wondered about, and so has Dr. James Hansen, is whether there is an upper limit on what happens in warming. You talked about one of the warmest times in the last billion years. Is there something that we know that can stop global warming from just taking off and perhaps blowing off our atmosphere?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, I think that the planet has a very good way of taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which is essentially to do with just plant life and animal life, which takes up carbon, and some of that then gets buried in sediment, and so that's therefore carbon that's no longer in the atmosphere. And I think part of the reason that it became so bad for a short period of time after the end Permian extinction was because that we've lost a lot of the normal ways of taking out carbon, such as the loss of plants and the loss of coal and burial like that. And that took a long time to recover, and so the Earth was just not as good at removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere for that time. But nonetheless, it did. The Earth did sort of, if you like, pull back from the brink. It didn't get any hotter than 40 degrees C at the equator. And so, therefore, things recovered. And even when it was at 40 degrees C at the equator, it was actually, life was doing fine at high latitudes. You just end up vacating the equatorial latitudes for a few million years.
Yeah, Lovelock said we might be huddled up around the Arctic seas. Well, as we finish up, is there anything else that you would like to talk to our listeners about?
About mass extinctions in general? I mean, what we haven't mentioned, of course, is the debate on them in terms of other factors as well, which, for example, the meteorite impacts. A lot of mass extinctions have the famous meteorite impact that did for the dinosaurs, of course, but other extinction events as well has been proposed. So there is a search on for the giant craters and things like that. But so far, I think the main culprit is volcanism and giant-scale volcanism. But even here, although I might have given the impression that every giant amount of volcanism causes extinction, there are still some fascinating times when we have giant volcanic eruptions and there are no extinctions. And so it's strange. The Earth sometimes responds to these giant eruptions and at other times it doesn't. And we don't really know why that is.
Has the Earth settled down now that it's aged? Are we less likely to get such giant volcanic action?
No, there's no signs of it slowing down, but I think what we know, there hasn't been one for about 15 million years or so, but I don't think we need to worry about one in the near future. We'd be able to detect if there's going to be any sort of huge-scale volcanism coming, and I don't think there will be.
Well, good. Thank you. We've been speaking with one of the acknowledged experts on past mass extinction events with decades of research and many scientific publications in the field. Dr. Paul Wignall is from the School of Earth and Environments at the University of Leeds in Britain. If you want to dig deeper, you can find links to the papers, a YouTube video, and other articles in my Radio EcoShock show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Paul, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
That's no problem.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.